This week on BSD Now, we have weird Unix things. Is it getting steamy in here? And an interview about BSD Sockets API. And no, these things aren't all related. It's going to be a good one. Buckle up for your place to be, SD. Now, episode 183, Getting Steamy in Here, recorded February 15th, 2017. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Jude.
And we're glad to have you with us this week. So we recorded this a tad bit early. We're getting, you know, ahead of ourselves here a little bit because we got a couple conferences coming up
back to back.
The next few weeks. So, yeah, back to back. It's like go to California, come home for 5 days, and then turn right around and go to Tokyo.
Mine's even worse, like three days
in between?
So, yeah. I fly home Monday night, even though I originally planned Tuesday, but I was like, Monday night will work a little better, even though it's a red eye and I'll arrive at home at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Sure.
So yeah, I get home Tuesday morning and then fly out to Tokyo that Friday afternoon.
Yeah. So I come home Wednesday night late and leave for Tokyo Monday. Yeah. So like I'm going to have a little bit of a longer weekend to try and get caught up on stuff around the house and get ready for the trip.
So I tried to use that as an excuse to not go. And Justin Gibbs is like, well, I fly home Monday night and then fly out to Japan on Tuesday afternoon. I'm like, okay. You
Holy can. Crap.
But it's his first time to Asia. So like to anywhere in Asia, but going to Tokyo. So I understand why he's going a couple days early.
Yeah, yeah. No, you definitely got to go early. That's good. Well, it's going to be a fun trip, and hopefully we get to see some of you folks out there. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yes.
Okay, so we got to get into some headlines here, though. So first up, as kind of our title indicated here, we have a story about Play on BSD with TrueOS. It's getting steamy in here, and I've had too much wine. So great title, by the way. Josh came up with that in the office here. That was fantastic. So we've done a couple tutorials in the past, of course, using Steam and Wine and PCBSD. But now that Play on BSD is now in the App Cafe, you now have more options than ever to game on TrueOS. And I know Josh is always big on, like, you got to play the latest games on TrueOS. So today they actually took a look at Play on BSD, how it works with TrueOS, and what you can expect if you want to give it a try in your own system. So you want to tell us a little bit about how they did that here, Alan?
I don't know. You know more about this than
you
I do.
You want me to keep doing it? Okay.
I don't know anything
so
about
of course,
TrueOS.
Okay. Well, you wrote some of the notes, so I didn't want to steal your thunder if you had something cool you wanted to do. But anyway, once you get Play on BSD install, which is just a package installation, not a big deal, right-click on the wallpaper, select Terminal, and then Play on BSD is going to pretty much do all the configuring for you. There's a couple simple options you'll want to configure, though, if you want to give yourself the optimal experience. So once you launch the Terminal, you just run the command Play on BSD. And, of course, in Lumina, you can use the search function and find it in the Start menu as well. But once it's open, a graphical menu is going to greet you with easy to navigate menus and even does most of the work for you. So, of course, the graphical UI is basically just hiding all the complexity of Wine and setting up Steam and whatnot in the background. So it lets you pick the game you want and get it set up without much hassle. And it'll set like the DLL overrides and all the little options. And, you know, all if anybody's been around a long time, like I've done Wine for 10, 12 years. It's been that long. Yeah, I remember playing WoW in Wine way back in the day, Warcraft 3 in Wine and stuff, right? But anyone who is an old school Wine user knows that sometimes it's like you got to go tweak it, and you go to Wine HQ and you look at the details on the game, and it's like, oh, you need to run these options in your Wine config so that you override specific DLLs and whatnot to make it all work perfectly. So Play on BSD just kind of does that all for you. So, of course, that's going to let you start gaming quicker without the headache involved. So if you're a PC gamer, you actually should definitely give Play on BSD a try. You'll be surprised probably how well it works. And if you want to know well ahead of time if your games are supported or not, you can head over to Wine HQ and do a search for the particular game title. And more often than not, there's a bunch of feedback there. People have said it works great or doesn't on this OS or whatever. Many people have tested and provided feedback and even have solutions for problems. So if you're still running into a glitch, you can go there. And yeah, 9 times out of 10, I've found somebody's already solved the problem, and it's just a matter of copying and pasting whatever commands they ran to do it. So, of course, a great resource if you ever have any other issues. So check it out. It makes it super easy. You might be surprised. I know everyone's been kind of hot on, you know, the Steam on Linux, for example. And when are you going to run the Steam Linux on TrueOS? Well, that's great, but we still find that the library of games is just so much bigger on the Windows mm-hmm. version of Steam, and those actually run just as good, if not better, in many cases here on Wine and Play on BSD. So if you're a gamer, give it a try. You might be pleasantly surprised, and then you can do this all in a Windows-free environment, which is pretty cool.
Yes, I'm going to have to organize a game with DEF CON sometime. I want to nuke somebody.
I haven't played that before. Is it any good?
Yeah, it's just it's basically, you know, there's 6 players, 5 players, something like that. Number of players, and you each get a continent, and you get 255 nukes spread across silos, bombers, and submarines, and you get some aircraft carriers, and you have to.
And you just nuke.
Each person starts with 100 million population spread across a bunch of cities on their continent, and you get 1 point for every citizen you kill, and 2 points for every one of yours that are left over, or something like that. One of the way, and whoever has the highest score at the end wins.
Right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, doesn't that kind of violate the whole, like, MAD principle, mutually assured destruction?
Well, yeah, no, basically, if you go too offensive, so you're like, your silos are either in one of two modes. Either they're launching missiles or they're in defense mode, but it takes time to switch.
Okay.
So while you're attacking, you're more vulnerable.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's cool.
Because in that game, that you can actually shoot down the nukes. They have some kind of, not SDI.
So you have good missile defense. Yeah. Okay, I see. Very
but,
cool.
But, you know, not while you're attacking.
Sure, that's true. That's
and then you have fighters that regenerate, but bombers that don't. And, you know, your air bases have extra nukes. So if your bomber makes it back alive, it could take a second one. But not if the enemy bombers bomb your air base.
That's really cool. Okay, I'll have to check that out at some point. So the next thing we have here is the weird Unix thing, cd/. Yes. So tell us what exactly that does.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't do anything special, really, in BSD, but there's a reason why it's a thing. So today, a friend told the author of this blog post an interesting fact about the cd command and other things. Right? Looking at the interaction here, if you try to cd/dmp, it does what you expect. If you cd//dmp, you'll see that when you print the work directory, you actually see the double slash. It's like, that's weird. But if you go 3 slashes, it just goes to 1 slash. How does that work? No matter how many slashes, it'll always count down. But if it's exactly 2, it doesn't. What?
Okay. Huh. Is that an oversight? I could see somebody thinking that was a bug.
No, it's actually part of the spec. Very interesting to see.
Okay.
So if you actually stat/\, you'll see they're actually the same file. So it's not like they're different files or something. So the specification for CD is here, and it's in the relevant bit says, an implementation may further simplify the current path by removing any trailing slash characters that are not leading slash characters. Right? So take off extra slashes on the end as long as they're not actually on the beginning. Right? So they had to word it that way because otherwise, //, the second slash, it's a trailing slash and you could remove it. And then the first one's a trailing slash and you remove it and end up with nothing. But anyway.
Sure.
Anyway, you can replace multiple non-leading consecutive slash characters with a single slash and replace 3 or more leading slash characters with a single slash. If, as a result of this canonicalization, the current path variable is null, no further steps shall be taken. So we can replace 3 or more leading slash characters with a single slash, and you can replace double slashes anywhere in the path with a single slash, except for if they're at the very beginning. So why is this the specification? So there's actually a rationale section in the specification, but it doesn't really explain it. But in another specification, you find a path name that begins with 2 successive slashes may be interpreted in an implementation-defined manner.
Okay,
so
I see where they're going with
when they defined
this
originally, I'm guessing there were a few implementations that treated // special as something different. And in order to not break those, the specification said you can keep double slash as something specific to each different OS, whereas every other version of that we can simplify. So that means your OS can define what //TMP means. You know, on most BSDs, it's just slash TMP. However, on some other ones, it might mean something else. So they actually point over to this Stack Overflow article where it was discussed. And it turns out that in Cygwin, it's used for Windows file sharing, UNC paths. Because normally in Windows, they're the other slashes. But in Cygwin, you know, even C:/ is the Unix slash. But on IBM's ZOS, they actually have it to access an MVS data set. I don't even know what that means, but...
Right. It's a thing.
Yeah. For Apollo Domain OS, it was also for UNC Paths. For UTEC, it was for a distributed file system they had. So it was //host/paths, so similar. AT&T System 5 Release 3 was for the RFS remote file sharing system. So //host/path, again, meant, oh, go talk to another computer. In Perforce, which is a version control system, kind of like Git or SVN, //depot/AB or whatever actually refers to files in the repository.
Sure.
In Blender, they actually use it to mean relative paths, which is just kind of weird. That's what dot slash is for, right? And so on. But
everybody's got
to
be unique.
Lots of different OSs might have implemented it differently, and so the spec allows for that to be a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's pretty funny.
That is interesting. Okay.
One of those little things you wouldn't have thought to ask.
Right? And people just assume, oh, that's an oversight, or, well, it's a thing. It's a real thing.
The reason why 1, 2, and 3 are different, but 4, 5, 6, 7 aren't, is something special.
Okay. So moving on here, we have testing out snapshots in Apple's next generation APFS file system. Yeah. So it looks like Adam Leventhal has been a little bit busy. So what's going on?
So he had looked at APFS when it was first announced, and he did a bunch of breakdowns of it on the DTrace blog. He's got a new article out from the last couple of days that's been syndicated to Ars Technica, and he actually started playing with it more. So now that they've announced that it's going to be shipped as part of iOS 10.3, he's decided to actually dig into it more. So previously, using DTrace, which is built into OS 10, he'd actually found the system call fs_snapshot, and he's like, oh, it's up to somebody else to actually go figure out how it works. But now, he says, the game is afoot, and he's interested. So he says, back in June, Apple announced this new upcoming file system, APFS, or the Apple File System. Everybody was quite eager to learn more about it. And he even managed to badge swap with someone to sneak into the conference to get his first glimpse at it. Apple's been using HFS for 30-plus years.
Yeah, it's a little long in the tooth at this point.
So digging into it, he used DTrace, obviously, to figure out what's going on. So he used DTrace and found the system call there. So then he decided, well, what I'll do is I'll write my own little C program here. It's about 19 lines, including all the includes and so on. And it will basically call this FS snapshot system call and create a snapshot. Mm-hmm. Of course, when he ran it, so he creates an APFS volume. And runs the snapshot command on it and gets operation not permitted. It's like, oh, of course that's what's going to happen, right? But Adam, being Adam, used DTrace to figure out what was going on. So on top of this, being an interesting delving into this file system is a great tutorial on how to use DTrace in anger. So he used DTrace to show the flow of system calls and callbacks as they're happening. So using this script, we can see that when he called the FS snapshot, it did VFS context current, and then it does a privilege check, and then that makes some other calls and it decides what happens. His problem is that the privilege check returns 1, which is permission denied. So he says, note that DTrace turned out 137,000 discrete points of instrumentation and then restored the system to its optimal state for this experiment. In the code flow, we see that the privilege check credential function jumps out as a good place to continue because of its name and the fact that FS snapshot calls it directly and it returns 1, which corresponds to the E permission denied. And so with a little Googling, he found the source code for it in the XNU source code and see that, it expects you to be root to do this. Sticking sudo in front of his binary and it takes a snapshot. It does something and doesn't put any output. So he tries again, and the second time he gets, hey, that file already exists. So obviously the snapshot was created. So then he actually dug through and actually built his own tool to do all of the functionality that was displayed at the demo. So at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, they showed off this utility, but didn't provide it to people, that could do all the basic snapshot functionality. And using Dtrace and some brute force, he actually managed to build his own tool that does all of those features. Right, listing the snapshots that exist, creating more snapshots, deleting snapshots, rolling back, reverting a snapshot, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after we got to the end of this, you know, now that we've figured out the proper use of the FS snapshot system call and reconstructed the Worldwide Developer Conference snapshot util, it's time to accidentally find that there's an already equivalent utility lurking in the macOS Sierra code. If you look under System Library File Systems apfs.fs/contents/resources, Apple has included a number of APFS-related utilities, including APFS_snapshot, and tantalizingly a tool called HFS Convert, which sounds like it might be possible to convert your file system in place. But the key value add of the APFS snapshot tool over the tool that he was emulating seems to be just this scary warning. You're using APF snapshot utility on pre-release versions of the Apple file system called APFS, which is meant for evaluation and development purposes only. Please note that APFS snapshot may be removed in the future release and should not be used for it should only be used for testing. But then it listed his snapshots that he had created. So when he did some Googling, there's not many hits for this, so it doesn't seem like anybody else has found this either.
So maybe they haven't fully committed to embracing that.
Yeah, or what they're going to call the tool. So then he tried to revert a snapshot and learn some interesting things. So snapshots let you preserve state for later perusal, and you can also revert an APFS volume to a previous state to restore the contents. The current APFS semantics around rollback are a little odd. The revert option succeeds, but it doesn't take effect until the next time the volume is mounted. So you actually have to unmount and remount the volume in order to see the reverted files, which is, you know, not something most people expect. So after the volume is mounted again, not only are the contents reverted, so, you know, to an empty directory in his case, because that's what he snapshotted, but any snapshots taken after the snapshot used for the revert operation are deleted as well. This is same thing happens in ZFS. It's just the way it works. But ZFS actually warns you when you try to roll back more than one snapshot. And it's like, you know, doing this will destroy these other snapshots. Are you sure you want to do it? Whereas APFS seems to be happy to just do it. Now, I imagine their tool eventually will do the check for you and be like, hey, are you sure you want to lose all your snapshots? But so one might expect APFS snapshot revert to immediately take effect and restore the contents of the volume to the previous state. Some technical issues likely make this challenging, such as what to do about programs that have files open within that volume when they're in the files about to disappear. So seeing if and how Apple decides to expose this functionality will be interesting. It would be quite surprising to do a rollback, forget, keep writing to the device, and then discover that all your work was undone on the next reboot. Whereas with ZFS, you know, when you do the rollback, it happens live. And, you know, it's your problem if you have some files open. But he says, you know, definitely a work in progress. But he says, another reason Apple may not have wanted people messing around with snapshot is the fact that it appears to be quite incomplete. Winding yourself into a state where only a reboot can clear a mounted snapshot is pretty easy, and using snapshot seems to break the disk utils. So when he runs disk utils, including the option, I have been warned that APFS is pre-release and that I may lose data. You have to specify that option when you want to start the program. It does seem to actually cause it to be very confused.
Okay.
But he says...
that's a very handy warning.
Watch this space and most likely his blog on dtrace.org, and he will continue to mess around with it.
Oh, very cool. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that, see what he's able to suss out in future updates. Okay, so before we get to our interview this week, really quick, we need to do our first sponsor. We're going to be starting with DigitalOcean. Website for that, digitalocean.com. You want to go there and get signed up right away because you can start making droplets and you can make FreeBSD droplets. How cool is that?
FreeBSD ZFS droplets.
Yes, you can do ZFS natively in DigitalOcean. It's really, really cool. And they even have block storage you can attach to now. So if you want to make a second pool and maybe share it or move it back and forth between droplets, you know, like that's a thing.
Your droplet comes with a little bit of SSD backed storage. But if you need, say, 16 terabytes of extra storage, you can do that via the block storage, and you pay per gigabyte. So you just decide how big the volume you need to be.
Yeah, that's don't pay that's for really, space really cool.
you're not going to use. Especially since you can always grow it later. So, yeah. And like you said,
very
they have
stuff.
Compute, they have storage, they have interesting networking options, including the new load balancer, you know, IPv6, reverse DNS, all the stuff. They have monitoring, and a greatly useful feature for me, honestly, is their team support. We can create an account and assign multiple people privileges to it, but, you know, they don't get my credit card. I don't share my password with the other members of my team. I can just say, you know, you have access to start and stop my droplets or whatever.
Sure.
Makes a big
difference.
Well,
definitely check it out. And when you do, when you create that account, don't forget to use the coupon code FREEBSDNOW. That's what gives you the $10 credit and also lets them know that you heard about it here on BSD Now, which is good stuff. You'll want to check it out today. And of course, you know, get in touch with those guys. They're adding new features and functionality all the time. So very, very a nimble company. And check out their APIs too. If you're programmatic and, you know, bent towards scripting like I like to do, you'll probably want to take a look at how cool their APIs are. Some neat stuff you can do spinning those up.
So this week we're joined by Tom Jones from University of Aberdeen.
Yeah, I guess that will do. Yeah. Yes.
So the first question we always ask people is, how did you first get introduced to Unix?
To Unix?
Yes.
When I was a teenager at high school, we did a programming course at some point that I really enjoyed. And I went to the local library and I started taking out books. And there was a Learn Unix in 24 Days book that I took out and read, and I learned how to use the shell and shell commands. So that's how I got started in Unix.
Yeah, and how did you get introduced to FreeBSD?
I guess I was one of these teenagers that's quite common where I tried like lots of Linux distributions. And in a strange way, I was having a lot of trouble with tutorials online using a Mac because everything was a bit different because it was all not GNU. So I tried Linux distributions because they were closer to what I was expecting. I tried more and more, and then eventually I started looking at BSDs. And while I was a student, I used OpenBSD a bit, and I played with FreeBSD a bit.
Is there more?
Yeah. And then I guess I came away from that for quite a while. And then I started working doing internet research at the University of Aberdeen. And the opportunity came up to do a port of a TCP congestion control algorithm called NewCWV. So I ported that across to FreeBSD. And to do that, I had to run FreeBSD quite a lot. And I really liked it. And I replaced my work Macs with FreeBSD. And I've been using it since then nonstop.
Oh, cool. So you were here talking about the Neat project. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the Neat project is it's a EU Horizon 2020 project that is trying to reinvent the socket API for the modern network. And we see that in the network there's a lot of problems deploying new things because the network itself is a bit old and crotchety. And the APIs we have are also... They're not great. The socket API is very old. It's done well so far, but it doesn't give us any ability to move forward with the protocols we use. So the Neat project is a set of APIs that runs over normal sockets, normal transport protocols, but it gives us the ability to do selection, fallback, and handover so that when new protocols are available, we can use the new protocols.
Yeah, and so one of the things I saw you talking about was SCTP, which has been in FreeBSD for ages, but I've never seen anybody use it for anything.
Yeah, so the SCTP protocol came around in the mid-90s. It came out of... I think it came out of a telco need to have reliable datagram services between cell towers and in their backbone. It's used a lot in SS7, so it's a protocol that's used tons, but nobody ever sees it. And Michael Tookson, and I think Randall did a lot of work for it when they were in industry before they left. And they came out and they ended up taking their implementation into FreeBSD. And so it's a first-class citizen in FreeBSD. It's built into the kernel by default. The FreeBSD stack is built into user space for user SCTP, which is deployed in web browsers, and this is what drives data channels and WebRTC. So it's a really cool protocol that can do really cool things. It has every interesting network solution you can think of built into it. Is just almost completely unknown.
Yeah. Cool. So can you tell us how the Neat project actually utilizes it?
So the Neat project offers a single API over transport protocols. We have an abstraction built on libuv, so we have an event-driven system. We have what we call a Neat flow. And a Neat flow is equivalent sort of to using a socket. It uses sockets underneath. And the Neat flow is a single API no matter what your transport protocol is.
So you write your program once, but it'll work with any of the transports.
You write with the same semantics for all of these, and you get the expected result out.
But it takes care of all the underneath, deciding which one to use and adapting your one request into what it's going to need to be?
Yeah, so there's a mechanism that was developed by Apple called Happy Eyeballs, and it's meant for choosing between IPv4 and IPv6 for HTTP traffic. So if you're writing Apple software and you do an NS URL request, it can do the selection for you, so it will see if the names are in DNS, and then it will balance out fairness for TCP setup for this. We have a different set of algorithms with the same name, unfortunately. It's called Happy Eyeballs, but it does selection between IPv4, IPv6, SCTP, and TCP. Mm-hmm. And we can now request this as a high-level, reliable transport. And Neat will choose the right transport protocol to use based on what's available on the network path. And if you get SCTP, you get all of the benefits from it, like multi-homing and multi-path. And if you don't, you get TCP, you still have a predictable data channel to use. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, instead of having to design a program that's going to use SCTP and then fall over when it's not available, you write to this protocol or this API and it just uses the best thing that's available.
Yeah, so we move all of the code where you figure out what the network is doing away from you so you can build your application and we handle this. Mm-hmm. And we're very open about what we do. It's easy to find out what the choices the stack has made and why. So it's clear what you're getting from it.
But so you don't have to think about it, but the data's there if you actually want to know what's going on.
Yeah. So you can naively write an app and you can get cool benefits. And in the future, if we add new transport protocols, your code doesn't have to change. Mm-hmm. You update your library and you link against something new, so this has changed. But you get the new protocols and you get all the benefits that you want. Mm-hmm. You just don't know when you're writing that they exist yet.
Right. Cool. What are some of the things that you've done with this Neat protocol or stack?
So it's a Neat stack. We use normal transport protocols underneath. Mm-hmm. We have ports right now for doing file transfers through rsync. Mm-hmm. We have a partner who does a lot of SDN stuff. So the Neat system can integrate with an SDN orchestrator and we can do selection for your file transfers. So there's a nice piece of automation there. And we also have a port of this stack to Mozilla Firefox. And we have Mozilla as a partner in a project, and we have Neat right now running over it. And we have a demo we're building right now that shows a HTTP download. And if you get TCP, you just get a normal download. If you get SCTP on our multi-homed host, you get a download at twice the speed because we can do CMT and share between the two interfaces.
And so for the rsync one, could you actually have it do two parallel TCP connections?
This isn't a case we've tried to build for, but we support MPTCP. Mm-hmm. MPTCP is just a socket option.
Right.
But we support it on Neat, so it should be possible if you can run MPTCP, then definitely. If not, I don't think it would be hard to integrate this if we had a case to really push it forward.
Right.
We're building the things we have developer time for, but
we're
definitely looking for people to come and get involved and help us build this out and make it a really useful networking library.
Right, and mentioning that, you say all the code for this is up on GitHub and you update it in real time?
Yeah, so all the code's on GitHub. It's github.neat-project/neat, and that'll be the repository. Mm-hmm. All of the code is available. We are an academic research project. And all of the papers we're doing that drive and justify this are also available online at neat-project.org. Mm-hmm.
But your GitHub repo, unlike some, is actually, live as you're doing it?
Yeah. We don't have enough people to abstract this away, so we just do it in
Sometimes you see, once every couple of months, they dump some code, but this is real time.
No, you can see all the branches, you can see everything happening, all the activity. You can tie bug fixes in the SCTP stack and FreeBSD to Neat commits, because you can see the two of them happening if you watch both logs. Completely open. There's no point trying to do this in private. We're building an API for everyone.
Yeah, cool. So if people are interested, what areas do you need assistance with?
We need people to build applications with this. The library's still quite young. We've been doing development for about a year. We're integrated with Firefox and rsync, and we can run over things and you can port code to this and it will work. But everything we port shows lots of bugs. The more things we port, the more bugs we find, the better this works. Getting the Firefox support in created like 300 commits, but it was making the code so much better.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any future uses you envision that you'd really like to see?
Oh, that's a hard one. I quite like to see us become the default choice for doing research development. Mm-hmm. Because it is such a nice API. We abstract away security for you. Mm-hmm. I did the DTLS implementation. I never want to look at OpenSSL ever again.
Yes.
I want to use the neat API for it. It's really nice.
Like you said, for that, if you decide you want a secure connection, you just set a flag and give it the certs, and it does.
Yeah. You give it the client flag, and we infer you want security from that. And you have your client cert, and it happens. And it's all transparent. You still do the same read and write calls, and the details are gone, and it works.
That seems even better than all these. Yeah, a couple of different SSL replacement APIs that come out to make it easier, but it's like, if I could just connect and say secure equals true, problem solved.
So this is the hard thing, and this is the issue with the project itself and showing it to networking people, is networking people that know how networks work, they don't want this.
Right.
They maybe want parts of it or the event loop stuff, but they know what they want to do with the network, and they have the experience, and they want to twiddle with little knobs and do things. Mm-hmm. This is really a great API of, you don't really care, but you want to just run normal primitives over it, and you want to do normal stuff.
Yeah, you want to write your application and have it just work.
Yeah.
You have to know about networking to write an application.
And almost all the time, that's all anybody wants. And occasionally, they want to touch something lower layer. Mm-hmm. And we're not hiding this. Go has very nice network abstractions that are almost comparable, but it's very hard to access the things beneath them. You end up having to write C for this. Okay, we are a C library, but we expose all of this. You can access the raw socket underneath if you have something special you need to do that's only your application case.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that. Being able to get at the raw socket in case I want to do something strange.
It's really important. It's also really hard not to allow.
Yes. Well, you could just like hide the file descriptor, I suppose.
Yeah, we could, but who wants that? No.
No, nobody. Exactly. Cool. So do you have any other interesting things that you do with FreeBSD?
Some stuff. So on top of the I did this congestion control protocol port. I wrote an SPI user space integration for FreeBSD, so the Raspberry Pi, you can access it from user space. Mm-hmm. There were two at the same time, so mine wasn't picked. Right now, I'm working on porting the vendor driver for MediaTek MT76X0U, mm-hmm. which is a USP 802.11 AC supporting chipset. Mm-hmm. They're really cheap; they're like $10. I'm slowly making progress with this.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No. I think that's great.
Well, thank you for taking the time in the middle of busy FOSDEM to talk to us for a few minutes.
Yeah, thanks for speaking to me.
Okay, thanks, Tom, for doing the interview. We appreciate you spending the time with Alan to do that.
You'd already given two talks that day at the conference. So.
I know. Right? And these people, it's good stuff, though. We want to make sure we share all this if you couldn't go out to the conference necessarily. Okay, so next up we have our next sponsor this week. We're going to be hitting IX Systems now, so ixsystems.com/BSDnow, where you can go there, fill out a little bit of information, name, email address, contact info, that kind of thing, and get in touch with our sales engineers, because if you're needing anything, we're talking little FreeNAS minis that go under the desk to, a full IX rack of just gear, like they can do that and everything in between.
If you need a little thing for your family photos, or if you need an entire cloud for your data center, that easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got all kinds of good stuff. So definitely get in touch with them, because they custom design a lot of this, right? Yeah. So what's really cool about IX is their sales engineers understand Unix, understand technology, understand the services you're going to run. So when you call up and say, I'm going to run a web server. Okay, how are you going to do that? What kind of stuff are you serving out of there? What kind of file sizes are we talking about? Like, oh, maybe you want these type of disks. Or no, you're going to do storage. Oh, you're doing NFS. Okay, that's cool. Like, these are the type of disks, and this is how we would lay them out to give you the best performance. sense at that block size or whatever. So like, it's really cool that they understand lots those of things.
Like, even for me, it was, all right, we need video transcoding machines, and we want only 1U, so it's cheaper to host that way.
Sure.
But, you know, the card needs a decent amount of air, and for some of these, we'd also like to put in a 10-gig NIC.
Mm-hmm.
But getting two expansion cards in a 1U case is awfully difficult.
Sure.
They managed to find a motherboard that's L-shaped. It's got basically a cutout where the video card goes so that you can actually get both cards in there. Like normally, you'd have the motherboard and a riser return one card sideways.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't be room for a second card underneath that because the motherboard's in the way. But this one, the motherboard is shaped so that you can actually get a card in under there.
Sure.
That made it all the difference for us. Suddenly we could fit our option of two video cards or a video card and a 10 gig NIC in one machine. And actually that chassis could, if we go, when we go with the single CPU option instead of the dual, there's actually enough room for a short height, short depth 10 gig NIC going the opposite way where the second CPU would normally go, and then two video cards in a 1U case.
So what you're saying is they kind of work with
yes,
you, right?
Like I kind of explain that what, happen. It's like, I need this, and I know that that doesn't normally fit, but what can you do for me? And they went away and figured out what they could do and found exactly what I needed to do.
Which is awesome. So they can do all kinds of crazy things. We've talked about some of the monster systems they built over the years, you know, tons of memory, tons of disks, you know, crazy CPU or just the number of 10
gig NICs in it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they can do all kinds of stuff. So definitely
even
get in touch with IX.
Custom metalwork. They've got it done. They
did
that.
That's right.
Water-cooled, overclocked i7 they did recently. Yeah. It's like, you know, if you ask some other vendor about that, they're like, no.
No, like, are you kidding? That's not something we saw out of our catalog. Right? So definitely get in touch with IX. Tell them you heard about it here. We would appreciate that. Okay, so we got a news roundup to get to. So first up, we have FreeBSD rc.d script to map Ethernet devices by the MAC address. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a mouthful. What are they doing here with this?
Yeah, so the problem the user had is they had their EM0, which is their wired Intel NIC, and then they had two USB NICs. And the problem was, depending on how the devices came up or whatever, every time they reboot or upgrade, the devices might show up in a different order. So, you know, USB Ethernet 1 and USB Ethernet, or USB 0 and USB 1 might be switched around.
Sure.
And then they get the wrong IP addresses going down the wrong cable, and that doesn't do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So this little script will actually rename the interfaces based on the MAC address.
Oh.
So you create a list of the MAC addresses and what you want to call them. So I guess first thing is what people might not know is that if you set... with ifconfig and FreeBSD, you can actually rename an interface. So you can actually, you know, ifconfig EM0 name, you know, out. And you can actually, all right, this is the outside interface and this is the inside interface. And you can actually name them that if you want. And you can also set a description so that if somebody else has to go look at the box, they can know what's going on.
Right.
So they're actually using that and in this case, mapping it to MAC address. So it finds the NIC with the MAC address, whichever you set, and renames it to X, and finds the other one and renames it to Y, and that way, when you set the IP addresses by the name, it's always going to be on the right NIC, even if the NIC has changed names.
Hmm. Okay.
And this way, it doesn't matter which of the USB NIC shows up first on the bus. They will get the right name, and the firewall rules will work, and it won't end up with inside and outside reversed or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's some functionality like this in MFSBSD where you can do this because you might not even know what the NIC's going to be called when you boot it up and so on. And there's the ifconfig underscore default, which finds the first NIC that's active. But it'd be nice to see this, whatever MFSBSD has and what this script is kind of integrated and put into the base system. And I think this would be one of those great junior jobs. You know, someone, say a viewer of the podcast who wanted to get their first patch into FreeBSD is actually looking at what this does and looking at what MFSBSD does and coming up with a nice clean solution that's easy to use so that people can actually map things like this.
Yeah, this actually looks pretty basic, about 100 lines of shell altogether, I'd say, minus the comments.
Yeah, with the, I think the MFSBSD one is a bit shorter and does it all in rc.conf, which I think is preferred to having a separate file. But with, you know, just a little bit of this, I think we could have a really nice solution.
Very nice. Yeah, I'd like to see that in. I think a lot of people would find that useful. Okay, so let's see here. Moving on. So Mog, a different take on the Unix tool cat. Mm-hmm. I could never switch to something like this just because I'm so used to typing cat, like my muscle memory wouldn't allow it.
Yes, but you know, in particular, cat is meant for concatenating files. Like you can do cat part one, part two, part three, redirect to the whole thing, and it will concatenate those files. That's what it's meant for. It just happens to get abused a lot to print things out to the screen, where most times probably you should be using less or something like that. But what Mog does is has a config file that looks at the type of the file you're about to cat and decides what to do with it, whether that's syntax highlighting, if it's a hex dump, because what you're looking at is actually binary, and so cat isn't going to do what you want. If you cat an image, it could just spit out, you know, this is the size of the image and what type it is and all this information about it. Or if it's an executable, it can run obj dump and actually tell you about the symbols and so on instead of, you know, throwing binary at your screen. Or if you do, like I've done too many times, accidentally cat a directory, it will just list the contents of the directory instead.
Sure.
Or if you cat multiple files, it can actually list, you know, put the headings above each file and make it possible for you to tell what's going on. So you can see in this example, it shows the size of the GIF file and it shows, you know, the contents of the license file and a bunch of other things. It's got a nice simple config where you can match based on the name, the file, the file's MIME type. You can do all a bunch of special processing for images, you know, what the different arguments you might do. You can do argument replacement, like replacing %f and all of the commands with something else, or %n for an integer. And so you can just set it up to, you know, if you see an image, do this. And if you see a text file, do this. And if it's seed, syntax highlight it for me.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty nice.
It also does everything based on its name. So if you don't like Mog as a name or whatever, or if you want to configure it different ways, if you just symlink it or hardlink it to, you know, the name feline, kind of like cat, then it'll read a different config file called feline RC and do what it says in that one. Well, so you can actually configure it in a couple of different ways. You know, even if you just want to call it like image cat and hex cat and whatever, you can configure it all that way.
That actually sounds really neat. I think more programs should do that. That's cool. Neat trick. Okay. Let's see here. So our next story, how Unix erases things when you type a backslash or backspace while entering text. Yes. Uh-oh.
So this is something most people probably would have assumed is not that complicated, right? But
never assume. Yeah.
So yesterday, he mentioned in passing that printing a delete character doesn't actually erase anything. This raises an interesting question, because when you're typing something into a Unix system and hit your backspace key, Unix sure erases the last character you printed. So how does it do that? The answer turns out to basically be what you'd expect, although the actual implementation rapidly gets complicated. When you hit backspace, the kernel TTY line discipline rubs out your previous character by, in the simple case, doing Control H, which is the delete character. So that moves the cursor back, but doesn't actually delete the character. Then it prints a space that overwrites that character, and then it prints another delete, which moves the cursor back to that blank slot.
All those mechanics just for deleting. Yes. Okay.
It says, you know, in the Unix kernel source code, you'll see that, you know, it's not actually printing the raw byte. It'll just use /b for backspace, because that's the control character for Control H. But, you know, this is, of course, just backing up one character is not always the correct way of erasing input. And that's when it gets complicated for the kernel. To start, we have tabs, because when the user backspaces over a tab, they want the cursor to go all the way back, the variable number of spaces, not just one, right? And so, you know, we have to deal with knowing what the tab stops are and so on. The kernel has a certain amount of code to work out what the column it thinks you're on, and then back up to the appropriate number of spaces to get to the previous column. All right. Sure. So, by the way, the kernel assumes the tab stop is every 8 characters. I'm not sure any Unix version lets you change this with, say, the STTY or equivalent, but if they did, that would probably make this even more complicated. It says, then we have the case where you quoted a control character while entering it. If you do Control V and then Control H, this will print out caret H instead of Control H.
Sure.
And then when you erase that, you're actually going to want it to erase both of those characters, not just the one. Right?
Yeah, because it was one command insert or one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You entered it as a unit. You want to erase it as a unit. So when you hit backspace on that, of course, you want the printed character to be rubbed out, not just the H, but the caret in the H. So the kernel needs to keep track of that and rub out two characters instead of one. The final complication for some kernels is multi-byte characters with a display width bigger than one. These kernels get to go through interesting gyrations. You can see an example in Illumos's ldterm.c in the ldterm CSI erase function. You know, it's just like, yes, really, some kernels actually try to handle this. This is interesting note. FreeBSD also handles backspacing a space in a special way. Because you don't need to actually rub that out with backspace, space, backspace, you can just do a single backspace. Other kernels don't seem to bother with this optimization. So in FreeBSD, if you're backspacing over a space, it doesn't do backspace, space, backspace. It just does the one backspace because it already knows that slot is blank.
Sure.
Most other kernels don't seem to bother with this optimization.
Right.
And it actually points to where in the FreeBSD code you can actually see this in the TTY discipline rub chair for rubbing out the character.
Nice. That's cool.
P.S. If you want to see the kernel's handling of backspaces in action, you usually can't see this in your shell prompt because it's almost certainly using a shell that supports command line editing or read line and so on. So if you actually do cat redirect to dev null and then type away, it will have be the raw kernel processing rather than special stuff from the shell.
Oh, you can just kind of see how the sausage is made. Yes. Oh, that just sounds horrible, yes, having to deal with all those special cases.
Yes, I'm glad this was code that was written a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes.
I just want to take this stuff for granted.
Yep. I don't want to think what it takes to erase an emoji.
That's right. Oh, very cool. Okay, so for our last story here in the roundup, we have, of course, we've been discussing the pending Wayland work that's been coming into the FreeBSD tree. But we wanted to point you today to the ports, which, of course, are all in the mainline FreeBSD ports tree now. So first of all, and I was wondering how they deal with this, actually, they've landed this in the graphics category. Since Wayland's kind of the anti-X11, you know, putting it in X11 servers, I think, is where it started originally. It didn't make a lot of sense, right? Yeah. I wonder if they'll have to make like an actual Wayland category at some point. We'll see. But a couple notes before you start installing packages and expecting Wayland to just work. So first of all, before you play with this does require that you have working DRM from the kernel side. So you'll want to grab either TrueOS with the latest packages or a build from Matt Macy's FreeBSD branches on GitHub before testing any kind of modern Intel GPU. NVIDIA with mode settings should be supported, so hopefully you'll be okay there. Second of all, just because you have shiny new Wayland, don't assume everything's going to work. Not all desktops just work. You may need to grab experimental Weston for compositor. Things such as KDE, GNOME, and of course Lumina and friends will eventually grow Wayland support in the future, but don't expect right now just to fire up, you know, whatever shell or window manager and just have it kind of work out of the box. So, of course, next up is feedback. The team needs some feedback. So this is all brand new functionality for FreeBSD. Mm-hmm. I think this is the first we've really had Wayland in some sort of user accessible form. So the maintainers are going to want to hear your feedback and results. So of course, those of us on the TrueOS side, we're interested as well, since we want to port Lumina over to Wayland sometime in the near soonish future. So please definitely give us some feedback on that. If you've experimented, tried around, what works, what doesn't, like, we'd like to hear all that because that helps us make a better decision on, you know, if and when to pull the trigger. And of course, a happy experimenting with it. This is an exciting time for desktop computing. I don't know when we've not done X. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been like since my entire professional Unix life, it's X.
Yep.
So this is huge. Mm-hmm. This is a big change. So I'm really excited to kind of play around with it here soon. And of course, we wish all you guys the best of luck with it too. And try and give some feedback. I know the people who worked really hard to port this over are going to want some as well.
Yeah. So actually, what I'm showing on the screen right now is a tweet from Hannes Lundberg, who did a lot of the work, saying, you know, he's now got everything he needs to run his Wayland desktop. He says X-Wayland is great, but it'd be even better with native Wayland apps. So he's actually in the screenshot. You can see on his Intel GPU in his MacBook Pro, he's running Firefox, showing a 1080p 60 frames a second YouTube video, not using up all his CPU. So he's got Firefox, Emacs using the Wayland Weston, thanks to X-Wayland. But it'll be very interesting once we start having native Wayland apps and actually seeing it in its full potential.
It's on our list. So Ken's writing that Lumina window manager, and that's going to be one of the first things that we target for is getting native Wayland support in it. That and then the login manager. If we can get those two bits sorted out, we should have a pretty complete Wayland stack all the way through. Yeah. So it's going to be really cool. So looking forward to that, and of course, keep you updated in the future about that. Okay, so we're hitting the Beastie Bits now. So first up, we have Faces of FreeBSD 2017. I know the FreeBSD Foundation has done this series in the past, and this time we have a Joseph Kong, who's been interviewed, a little bit of information about him on there. Do you want to add anything to that one?
So he wrote, Writing BSD Rootkits and FreeBSD Device Driver books. So, you know, definitely knows what he's talking about, but he tells a little bit about how he got started. He says, in 2003, he's working for the City of Toronto as a system administrator. One day, his manager asked him if he knew anything about FreeBSD. His response is, I've never heard of it. And he promptly gave him three FreeBSD machines to administer. After spending far too long figuring out how to install FreeBSD on my personal machine, I fell in love with its coherent, minimalistic, and clean nature, and he's been a fan ever since. He got warped into the community by George Neville Neal and Michael Lucas, coercing him into writing about FreeBSD and submitting patches, most of them being network-related. And then he went on to work for a series of different vendors making networking appliances.
Okay, very nice. So let's see here. So next up, we have a OpenSense 17.1 Eclectic Eagle has been released. And they got a nice little screenshot here to go with it. That's very, very cool. Right? But, of course, they talk about some new things about better language support, more secure, more features, etc. Let's see. What other features that includes FreeBSD 11?
Yeah, it's based on FreeBSD 11, which is nice, although based on benchmarking I did recently, using 11 stable, which is what will eventually become 11.1, the actual packets per second throughput has been about doubled since 11.0. With some changes.
Oh, nice. And
there's more to come, too. So, you know. Although, for PSense, or OpenSense, you know, you're looking at small devices, and you're probably not worried about passing more than a couple of million packets a second anyway.
True. Well, it looks like they have some new cooperative firewall forwarding, which allows Traffic Shaper and Captive Portal. Let's see. The install media now boots up with SSH on, so you can do headless remote installations. Has some of the hardened BSD ASLR and Pi stuff built in, PHP 7.0 compatibility for GUI improvements, and then they've added a bunch of languages too. It looks like Portuguese got a few, Italian, Czech, and FTP proxy plugin, Let's Encrypt plugin. Yeah, so some neat stuff. Very cool. So upgrade away, folks. Okay, next up, why you should start programming on Unix. Interesting, a new blog post about that.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people, when they want to get started writing code, they first think, well, why don't I build a web something, like a web app or something? It's like, actually, in that case, then you're diving into a sea of Java libraries, Ruby and Django modules, and dealing with getting your database relations right and all this stuff. Whereas if you start programming on Unix, it's one black terminal window. You have a file, or maybe two or three, and your text editor. And your whole project is those three files. There's no XML project files or any other crap like that. You know, the last thing of your environment, you know, the things you have in your environment are your compiler or your interpreter, and you feed it your source code, and, you know, it's friendly unless you feed it the wrong stuff, and then it gives you some warnings.
Right.
Yeah. Unix is probably the first very well-engineered OS, and it's changed a lot over the last 40 years. But in general, it's always been about writing programs. And, you know, that's why it's the best place to start.
Cool.
The Unix API is great. You can remember every function there, and you can write it from memory most of the time. There's maybe 200 functions, which if you read something like Unix daemon source code, it's pretty straightforward. Compare that to the iOS API, which has 80 different frameworks. And the framework is basically an API subset, sometimes very complicated. Of course, not all apps use every framework, but even using five of these means a lot more reading.
Sure. That makes
sense. And he has a simple example here of just making something that does, I think this is a calculator he wrote. And it's just, you know, 47 lines of code. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, definitely a good read. You should check that out. Okay, lastly, we have open SMTPD mail filtering.
Yes, this is just a very short how-to that shows how to install SpamAssassin, SpamPD, and ProcMail, hook it up with OpenSMTPD, and do mail filtering.
Oh, that's
so basically,
really cool.
You configure SpamPD to be running on port 10,025 and to relay mail to port 10,026.
Sure.
Then you set up your proc mail to take anything that doesn't have the or anything that does have the spam flag set to yes and send it off to the spam directory instead of the intended mailbox. And then it's just a matter of setting up your OpenSMTPD. So you listen on port 25 for in and out, and then you listen on port 10,026 for the mail to come back from the spam checking process. And they also set up one for DKIM. But basically, they say accept any mail from SpamD that is for my domain and delivered by and deliver it via procmail, or accept from any for his domain, and then when you get it, relay it out to SpamD. So all email that comes in will be routed to SpamD. SpamD will route it back into OpenSMTPD, which will send it off to procmail, which will put it in your inbox. Unless it's spam, then it puts it in the spam box.
Very nice.
And then it deals with aliases and sets them up and does the DKIM for signing. And done.
I've been meaning to switch over my home setup to OpenSMTPD. Someday.
The config is so short.
Yeah, it just makes me drool looking at this. Like, that is so easy. Is that all there is? Anyway, you should definitely check that out. Okay, so time for our last sponsor this week, which is going to be Tarsnap, the website for that, tarsnap.com/BSDnow, where you can go and grab a client for just about anything under the sun. So yes, you can do Windows, you can do Mac, you can do Linux. Of course, you can do all the different BSDs and a whole bunch of other things as well. But definitely check it out because the source code is all available. So Tarsnap is the only backup software I know of that really, you know, just publishes everything right up front. So you can roll your own binary if you like, you know, audit it, have a team of people audit it, verify it does exactly what it claims to do, which is backup everything securely. Everything's fully encrypted locally on your system and deduped all before it gets sent out over the wire up into the cloud. So as long as you have your key, you're the only one who has access to your data. Anything on the remote side is pretty much gibberish and meaningless to anyone else. So that's how data backup should be done.
Yep.
And because it's so efficiently deduped, you're not getting double billed and charged for sending the same stuff twice, which is fantastic. So definitely check it out today. Very cheap. Alan and myself use it. I'm still working off that same $20 I deposited like 2 years ago. Anyway,
turns
it's
out
definitely
all my
stuff.
Important personal and business files compress very well.
They do. Mine do too. And they don't change all that often. Exactly. So yeah, there you go. Anyway, check it out today. And I know you'll appreciate it as much as we do. Okay, so time for feedback and questions. So first up, we have Zane, who writes in, says, Alan and Chris, longtime listener, first time caller. I'm a developer, and after much consternation, I've been migrating my server infrastructure on DigitalOcean from Ubuntu 14.04 to FreeBSD 11. A test run of my existing configs on Ubuntu 16.04 went horribly wrong. He said it was a smooth transition from three Ubuntu rigs over to one FreeBSD rig with separate jails. Says, I love how logically everything is laid out on FreeBSD. I never could have imagined tools as nice as PF, Package, and EasyJail. He said, I'm very grateful to have your show as an education and entertainment throughout the process of migrating. He said, now on to my question, though. One pain point I was having was moving Ruby on Rails application that communicated with Postgres database. Moving the Rails app was fine, but some mailing lists and forums described horror stories about running Postgres in a jail. I'd like to have the Rails app and Postgres running in separate jails, but I don't want to risk the hassle of data corruption. I ended up migrating to MySQL running in jail, and so far that's been fine. The most recent tutorial I could find suggested enabling SysVIPC for jails on the host machine for Postgres, but after watching Brian Cantrill's talk on jails and Solaris Zones at Papers We Love, I was scared away from enabling raw sockets or SysVIPC for jails. For future reference, can you safely run the most recent version of Postgres on FreeBSD 11 jail without SysVIPC or raw sockets enabled? Thank you for everything.
I'm not sure about Postgres in that way, although one thing is a recent change. I don't know if it's in 11 or not, but there was recent work so that the SysVIPC namespaces are separated per jail so that one jail cannot see another jail's SysVIPC shared memory. That would require you to run the Postgres in the same jail as the Ruby on Rails app, but it would mean that it's safe to use the SysVIPC there without the worry that somebody would be able to read that data from some other
One of the folks in chat says that is fixed in 11. So,
but
very cool.
Yeah. So enabling SysVIPC isn't as bad now because it's separated out per jail. So, the concern there is gone.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully that helps you out, Zane, and we wish you luck with your migration in the future. Hopefully it goes well. Next up is Mohammed, who writes in about USB boot. He says, "Hey guys, it can't be said enough. Thank you for the awesome show." Well, we appreciate that. A couple episodes ago, someone asked about the music you play, and he said it was one of the first things that attracted him to his show. And he said, "I managed to find it a few months ago," and he's surprised nobody mentioned it, so he sent us the link.
Yeah,
thank
that was
you.
Something TJ wrote a long time ago. I forgot that was there.
Yeah.
We need to update our website a bit more, but
We do. He says, "So now for my question. I'd like to try out TrueOS on my laptop, but I can't spare the time to dual boot or install a secondary hard drive." He said, "I've tried running it on VMware Workstation, but the experience was horrible." Oh, that's a bummer. He said, "I've been using FreeBSD for servers since 2008, and I love it." He said, "I use Windows as my primary desktop OS, but I'd like to get some of the stuff that the non-Windows OS offers, like multi-tab terminal windows, etc." He said, "I do have a few 64 and 128 gig USB sticks lying around. Can I install TrueOS on one of them and boot off it just so I can tinker and maybe develop something?" So thanks again for the awesome show and keep it up. So yes,
I've
you could.
Done that. I actually built, it was this USB stick, but it's since been overwritten. But when Beehive was quite new, I had a version running on here that would, so that I wouldn't mess up my laptop while I was doing science at BSD camp.
Sure.
It's like, I need my laptop to work because in 2 days I'm giving a talk. But I want to try out this latest code from the person sitting beside me. So I wrote it. I put a Zpool on a USB stick and booted off of it.
Yeah. So you could totally do it. I don't recommend running long term off a USB stick with TrueOS. Like if you get attached to it or whatever, like don't. I wouldn't make that your long term strategy. ZFS on a USB stick.
Yeah. So ZFS will detect the
problems, especially consumer quality.
USB sticks eventually wear out, and the speed is not going to be great on a USB stick. But for just experimenting, it's an easy way to get started. And because it's ZFS, it'll be very easy to transition to a partition on your disk later. When you fall in love with it hard enough that you're willing to dual boot or replace an OS.
Just replace it. Just go all the way. Anyway, we wish you luck with that in the future. Okay, so next up is Chuck, who writes in about jail updating. You want to read this one out?
This is, "Hi, Chris and Alan. Thanks for all the knowledge you share on the show. When I recently had the opportunity to set up a new web server, I decided to give FreeBSD a try. I've been running Linux servers for years, and after listening to you guys for a while, I decided to give it a go on DigitalOcean, no less." So he actually blogged about the setup he used. "And I'm very happy with the setup. Basically, I have a FreeBSD server running Apache and MySQL within a jail hosting WordPress. I am using IOCage to manage the jail and PF to take care of the NAT and port forwarding from his IPv4 address. Now for my question. Since this system uses ports and packages and has a jail, what is the best way to keep everything up to date? I want the base system of the server, the packages and the ports of the server, and the jail and the packages and ports of the jail all to be updated. Coming from Linux, where I could just run, sudo yum update and have everything updated, this seems much more complex." Well, if you're using just packages, then you just run package update and package minus J, the jail name, update, and it'll update. You have to remember, jail's like a completely separate installed OS, so you basically would just have to do the equivalent of yum update in both the host and the jail. Now, if you compile things from ports, it's a little more complicated, but it's really mostly the same process.
Sure. Well, he was asking about the Base system, though, too. So with that, it's a little more complicated. You got to run FreeBSD update and then update in the jail. It's a little harder. IOCage will do it, but yeah, it's not ideal. Package base is what you really are after, though, going forward in the future, where it literally will just be one package command to update the jail or update it even from the host, right? And that'll include the base and the packages. You could try that now with TrueOS. I think FreeBSD, Alan, you said they're still targeting 11.1 to have package base, although we'll see if that slips or not. But anyway, that's the feature you're really looking for, though, and that is coming down the pike here in the near future. Like I said, if you grab a jail right now and throw TrueOS and run 12 current on it, great, but maybe that's not what you want for this production system. Maybe you want to run on 11. So
yeah, I guess I forgot about the base system there. So yeah, you'd have to run FreeBSD update to update the OS and package update or package upgrade to update the packages. But that's only two commands, so it's not that much worse. And then you can use IOCage or EasyJail or whatever you're using to update the jail the same way for the base system. And then the package, you can just run package minus J, the number or name of the jail, and then upgrade, and it'll run package upgrade in the jail as well.
Okay. Very cool.
But yes, next we hope to have it all solved with package soon.
Soon. It'll just make everyone's life easier. I say we're using it on TrueOS, and it's like I can't imagine not using it now because it's just that much easier. But anyway, David writes in saying, I am curious about how is Lumina so much different from LXQT? He said, what is it about LXQT that doesn't make it suitable for TrueOS? He said, I'm anxiously looking forward to Lumina 2.0. Is it more than a year away? Will TrueOS have something like Snap or Flatpak? He said, I want to be able to dual boot, but it's way above my skills. It's just easier for me to have two computers. So let me try to answer these for you. So obviously different developers, different code base, I think different license too. I don't think they're BSD licensed. LXQT is the continuation of the LXDE desktop, which I think was GTK based back in the day. The reasons it's not quite as suitable for TrueOS is A, you know, we're not directly working on it, and B, it's developed on Linux and ported to FreeBSD. So we're obviously wanting something that's done the opposite, developed on FreeBSD for FreeBSD and understands FreeBSD things, so we're not fighting the port trying to, you know, fix Linuxisms constantly. Second part of your question was, is it more than a year away? I don't know. It's a good question. I'll have to ask Ken and get back to you on that. I'm thinking the window manager is probably 3 to 6 months away for beta trials begin. So hopefully before the end of the year, we have something new. And I'm actually not familiar with Snap or Flatpak. Alan, are you familiar with those tools?
I thought they're package managers. Like, I don't actually know, but I had some suspicion that Flatpak is kind of like the old PBI system.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know.
Future of application distribution. They have a fancy website with a sentence. Let's see.
It sounds like it's just a big fat package that includes the thing you want and all its dependencies. So it kind of sounds like PBIs to me.
Yeah. Everyone else has tried. You know, there's been like three or four other projects I've seen that have tried doing that on Linux and Unix, and it's always the same thing. If I go look, there's, 10 apps available for it?
They've run into the same problems you did, right?
Yeah. We're all trying to solve the same problem. It's dealing with the dependencies, right? So packaging is neat, but it's tough to do the runtime bits to make all that work. Anyway, at the moment, no, we're not doing anything like Flatpak or Snap. We've switched completely over to PKG, and we're using that so we can do a true rolling release.
Yeah, but basically, anyway. The problem is a little differently solved on FreeBSD because we have a port tree that means that all the bits actually fit together, or mostly anyway.
We do.
It's impossible to have all 27,000 bits fit perfectly together. But, you know, because you're building things from source, in that case, you're... So, if you look at the way Debian builds packages, random developers compile individual packages on their individual machines. This obviously leads to the packages not all being built in the identical environment. Whereas on FreeBSD, packages are built by Poudreur in a clean jail with only their dependencies or whatever, it means that everything is built in exactly the same way, usually on exactly the same machine. And that machine is usually really beefy. But the point of that is that all those little bits fit together better. And, you know.
When you try and repackage everything, the trick is not packaging at once. Like, you can do that. That's essentially what the whole package system is if you take it as a whole, right? But it's when you try and have multiple copies of that running, I guess, is where it gets difficult, right?
Really, the problem comes is things like Ruby, where they will have a dependency. So you have two different Ruby apps, and they each have a dependency on a different version of the gem and they're not compatible. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in general, normal C library type things, that's versioning is done in such a way that, oh, you can just use the newer one because it has some newer symbols, but the old symbols are still there and it just works.
Sure.
Whereas in the gem, it'll be like, ah, actually, no, we just blew the ABI up even though it was a point release.
Yep. But anyway.
Yeah.
Well, David, you know, we wish you luck with your TrueOS journey, and hopefully, you know, it goes well for you. But yeah, we'll look forward to bringing Lumina 2.0 to you in the near future. Okay, nice. It's actually time to wrap up the show here. So a couple things we want to mention, of course, feedback at bsdnow.tv. That's where everything needs to go. That's where comments, questions, show ideas, topics. If you find stories out on the internet, yes. You know, me and Alan can't read everything, and JT can't read everything either.
We also
either.
Just don't know what you want to hear about.
Yeah, sometimes you find something where like, oh, I didn't even think about that being interesting, you know, or maybe it was just like, oh, I already knew about that, but, you know, maybe you and the audience hadn't. We want to pass that along. So send it over to feedback@bsdnow.tv. That way we see it. It'll probably get stuck in the queue, and then we'll queue it up for a future episode. So don't freak out if you don't get responded to right away. It is being saved for a future episode, and hopefully you'll get your question read on the air, and we can help answer that. Anyway, thanks, everyone, for being here this week, and we'll look forward to speaking at you again here soon.